All right, please help me welcome our speaker tonight. We have Kat V from the Firing Line Home Group.
Hey guys, my name's Kat. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Hey, hey Zoom. My sobriety date is August 20th, 2017. I have a home group. It's the Firing Line Big Book Meeting. We meet 5 nights a week, Monday through Friday. We have a different leader come every night and read line by line and share their experience and break it down. I have commitment at that home group. And I have the privilege and honor of sponsoring people when asked to do so. I mention all of those things not as a pat on the back, but I tried coming to AA 20 years ago, and I thought I was doing AA. I never got a sponsor. I never did the steps as outlined in the book. I never got a home group. I never got a commitment. I never took other people through the steps that I didn't do. Never did any of those things. And I never stayed sober. So that's a really big, important piece of what changed this time around. Let's see. So when I was little, I remember being absolutely driven by fear. That might seem like a minor thing, but for me, my entire world was run by fear. And I would wake up in the morning as a little girl, like before I had any reason to be full of fear from anything going on in my world. I would wake up in the morning, it would be like I would get into the passenger seat and fear would get behind the driver's seat and fear would just drive me around all day. And it would dictate what I would say, what I would do, what I wouldn't say and wouldn't do because I was usually paralyzed by fear. I couldn't even look you in the eye or make any sort of connections with friends at that age. And I would continue to be driven by fear until I found relief in alcohol. And then I was driven by the phenomenon, the allergy being activated and the phenomenon of the craving, or I'd be driven by that mental obsession and I would just keep drinking. I wouldn't know I was being driven by those things. I had no idea I was an alcoholic until August of 2017. There's a story that really kind of illustrates what it felt like to be driven by fear as a child growing up and all through my teens and young adulthood, and then what it felt like to be driven either by the allergy being activated and not having a choice in drinking, or being driven by that mental obsession and not having a choice over whether I would drink or not again. And at first I thought it was a silly story, but it really kind of illustrates what it felt like to be driven either by fear, by that physical allergy and the phenomenon of craving, or by that mental obsession. I was at my fiance's shop one night and we called an Uber to get us home. So he lives here in Philadelphia, or his shop is here in Philadelphia and we live over here, right? Now I know how to drive, us from his shop to our apartment, right? I know which roads I take, I know which turns I would take, but I'm not driving, we're being driven by this Uber driver. And the ride starts off perfectly. And I'm not worried about us getting, from point A to point B. This guy has GPS and we figure he's going to follow it. And at a certain point, once we got through Center City, there's this Fifth Street underpass that he has to take to get to our neighborhood. But if you don't take the underpass, you end up on the bridge going to Jersey. And we were in the backseat having a conversation. And I have faith and trust that this guy is going to follow the directions and take the Fifth Street underpass to get us home. And when the car starts to veer right towards, the on-ramp to the Ben Franklin Bridge, we start protesting in the back seat. And I'm like, no, that's not the direction we want to go. We don't need to go to Jersey tonight. You're going the wrong way. And the guy either didn't understand us or didn't know what we were talking about or just didn't listen to us. And I felt helpless in that back seat. He was driving. I wasn't in control. He was in control of where we're going. And once we piped up and shouted a little louder, like, "Oh, dude, you're going to go across the bridge to Jersey, go the other way," it was too late and we had gone on this on-ramp to the bridge. And when he finally started to pay attention and listen to us, he does something even more unsafe. He slams on the brake of the car. And there's all these cars behind us. And we're like, no, you can't slam on the brake. We're going to get rear-ended. Keep going, right? And so we're sitting there and we assume he's going to, put it into gear and go across the bridge and we'll just take, a roundabout way to get home. And what he does next is throw the car into reverse to try to reverse off the on-ramp to the bridge into oncoming traffic. And we're like, what the fuck are you, what are you doing, dude? We're going to get in an accident, right? But we're not in control. I'm not driving. It doesn't matter what I say, what I do. I can't get this guy to, do the right thing, do the safe thing, do the direct route home. And then we get slammed in, the rear by a car behind us. And we actually, I did a sigh of relief because I'm like, this nightmare is over. We've been in an accident. Now the cops are going to come. It's going to take a while to get home, but at least this nonsense is done. And it wasn't. He then puts the car into gear and slams on the gas and tears across the bridge and flees the scene of an accident, right? And at that point, we kind of give up protesting from the back seat. Then we're in Camden, and it's a sketchy neighborhood. He's going the wrong way down a one-way street, making illegal U-turns. And we stop fighting. We stop telling him what to do or where to go because he's not listening to us. He's the driver. He's the one in control. He's the one with his foot on the gas or on the brake or putting it into reverse or taking the steering wheel and going this way or that way. No matter what we say, no matter what we do, it doesn't matter. He has the power. So that's the kind of fear I was driven by from a really young age. And I feel like that fear paralyzed me. And the first time I felt a little bit of relief from that fear is when I discovered alcohol. I thought that I drank normally, like as a teenager, and after I graduated high school, moved down to the city and started to bartend. And in that industry at that time, everyone drank alcohol and did the Goodfellas form of alcohol. And I thought that was normal, right? It wasn't just my coworkers. It was the managers. It was the owners of these businesses that were doing it or sometimes providing it. And I was young. I was having fun. I was making more money than I ever had in my life. I was getting to work and doing my shifts. I didn't see a problem. And that continued for a while. At some point, I became aware only because other people started to point out that I didn't seem to drink like other people, but basically doing that other form of alcohol kind of countered that. When that wasn't available, I would drink so much so fast that it was straight to blackout, pass out, or throwing up, like at 8:30 at night. And that was just not acceptable to me. I wanted to keep drinking and be able to keep up with my friends. After a little bit of time, someone introduced me to the Trainspotting form of alcohol. And this may sound insane, but if you're drinking as an 18 or 19 year old is so out of control that you think the Trainspotting form of alcohol is a good substitute for alcohol because you can't control your drinking, you might be an alcoholic. But that wasn't on my radar at all. And what I found is that if I did this other stuff, right, which I had to do alone and I had to do in secret, none of my other friends were doing that, right? I didn't have to drink as much, or I came to find out at all, right? And for the first week or two, this plan worked brilliantly. I wasn't passing out. I wasn't blacking out. I wasn't throwing up in the corner at 8:30 at night. My friends actually patted me on the shoulder and was like, oh, you seem to have your drinking sort of under control. And I was like, yeah, I do, right? And no one knew. And the plan wasn't to get hooked on this, but that's absolutely what happened. And things went downhill pretty fast. And eventually I reached out to get some help and started a couple years of just this, you know, merry-go-round of going to detox, staying for inpatient, going to outpatient IOP rehab after work, going to another fellowship first, and then someone directed me to AA, and then relapsing and repeating that over for a couple years. And I didn't know what was wrong. I thought I was doing AA by showing up and just sitting in the chair and attending these meetings. I saw these steps on the wall. I didn't know this big book existed, right? So the meetings I went to 20 years ago out in Chester County, a few of them had a big blue book on a book stand at the front of the room where the chairperson would be, but no one ever opened it. No one opened it. When they would read how it works, I thought that was just some mumbo jumbo they came up with that they read from like a photocopied piece of paper at the beginning of every meeting. I didn't know how it works was an entire chapter in this book. I didn't know the steps were also in this book and the directions of how to do these steps were in this book. I was confused, and there was so much God all over the place, you know, God on the steps in the wall, the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. And because no one ever opened this and said, this is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought this was the Bible, which convinced me that this was a religious program and you guys were all full of crap, which just, you know, allowed for a lot of resentment in that area. I'm sure that there were women who approached me back then, but it was probably painfully obvious to them that I was not ready to do any of this. And so they followed the directions in the book, which is to not chase someone, right? But I was confused. No one ever presented the disease of addiction or alcoholism in a way where I could identify with it. Basically, I knew it was a heroin addict because I was addicted to it, but I didn't understand what the disease, like the spiritual malady was. I had no idea about the physical, allergy or the mental obsession. I knew I was suffering from both of those things, but I didn't know that that's what they were. I thought that I just had mental diseases and disorders, and that once I started, I couldn't stop because there was physical dependence, because I was doing a physically addictive substance. And after I got out of my final treatment for that, it wasn't even on my radar that I couldn't safely consume alcohol or other forms as long as it wasn't that form. And again, I'm sure that there were people who told me that, but I didn't listen. And I went on to continue to drink and tried to keep it to drinking at first. And I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink without adding things to keep me up. And eventually got into a relationship with someone who was doing the Breaking Bad form of alcohol. And the next, the next 20 years of my life were drinking, and like 13 or 14 of them were with that Breaking Bad form of alcohol. And this is how delusional I am, because I wasn't sticking a needle into my arm. I thought that this way of living was so much improved than my old way of living. Because there was no physical dependence on this new substance I was doing. There was no physical withdrawal if we couldn't get it, if, you know, whatever, that it wasn't as much of a problem. And any time I tried to do less of that stuff, my drinking was just so much more out of control, and my behavior and the consequences of my drinking were so much more unmanageable. There was a period where I just stopped drinking altogether and was just doing this other stuff. And in my heart, like, I knew I shouldn't be doing it. But again, it wasn't even on my radar that I suffered from a spiritual malady, or that that once I started to pick up anything, right, this allergy was activated, and that's why I couldn't stop. I just thought I liked getting loaded all the time. That was just the way that I thought it was. And there's in-between times where we would run out, or I'd wake up with pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I would promise myself I'm not going to do it today or until later, and then found that I couldn't not do it. In the absence of a physical dependence, I started to become concerned, because that didn't seem right. But I would always convince myself that I just changed my mind. That, yeah, this morning I decided I wasn't going to do anything today, but now I've decided it's later, it's the evening, I deserve, or whatever. And it didn't matter. Anything could be a trigger for me. I hate that word. But anything could be a trigger for me to decide that it was acceptable to drink and get loaded, right? It's a crappy day and I stub my toe and, you know, I say an expletive and that's a reason to drink. Or it's a wonderful sunny day and I get some good news and that's a reason to drink and celebrate. It didn't matter what was going on externally in my life, what was going on internally. I would always find an excuse to justify why I had changed my mind after I'd promised myself I wasn't going to. And I wasn't one of these types of drinkers that was swearing it off forever and for good. Like, even right up until the end, I didn't wander back into AA in 2017 with a desperate desire to cease drinking forever. It was just like I found that I was trying to stop, like, even for a day, and I couldn't, and I didn't know what was going on. And so that lifestyle went on. Like I said, there were two decades of drinking and 13 of those with the Breaking Bad stuff, and it got really sort of wild and out of control, and I just didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't know what I suffered from, like, at all. And five and a half years ago, I got into a relationship with someone who just drank. And it seemed like he drank like me or similar to me, which was good news because I had no intention of modifying or moderating my drinking. But he didn't do drugs, like, at all, ever. Like, he might have smoked weed or taken some, you know, mushrooms in high school or college, but he'd never snorted anything, never shot anything, never smoked anything out of a pipe. And I was still doing this other stuff to keep me up. And I felt that I was faced with a decision to make. I thought there were only two alternatives. I thought the first was to go to him and approach him and tell him, hey, I like doing this other stuff to keep me up for a week, and I hope you're okay with it. And I thought the other option was to continue to do it behind his back and hope I didn't get caught. I had no idea that there was a third option, which was to just try to stop doing it. And the reason why that option wasn't even on my radar is because I knew inside that the moment I tried to just drink successfully without the aid of that other stuff, it would just be a train wreck. And the thought of not drinking the way I need to drink was not an option. So I'm a coward and I don't approach him to tell him I do this other stuff. I just keep doing it behind his back. And the longer I get away with it, the more full of fear I get, because I'm convinced that he's going to find out and I'm going to lose him. And I love this man, right? And he treats me well, and I want to build a life with him. But I'm too full of fear to tell him the truth. I'm too full of fear to keep trying to use it behind his back. And so I attempt another experiment. My experiments are wacky. That page in the book where it talks about, like, the, you know, the beer experiment or switching to natural wines or taking a trip, not to sure. My first experiment was like, let's put them down the vodka and pick up a bag of dough, right? Like that was a terrible disaster, right? And then it's like, let's pick up the alcohol so you won't pick up the dope again, but we're going to have to do this Breaking Bad stuff for 13 years. It was just, it's crazy the kind of lies that you'll tell yourself to justify a lifestyle that is absolutely just killing you. But I told myself all of those lies, and then I began to lie to this man that I absolutely loved. I finally get too full of fear to continue to hide it behind his back or hide it from him behind his back. So I start the experiment of trying to not do it, right? And continue the drinking the way that I drink. And it doesn't work. It fails miserably. A bunch of external consequences start happening as a direct result of my drinking. And if you would have asked me then, I would have thought like, oh, those might be things that make me an alcoholic. But what I came to learn is none of those things make me alcoholic. None of the external consequences, not the DUI I got, you know, several years ago. DUI doesn't make me an alcoholic. I would do this thing where he would be at the bar after work, which was across from his shop. He'd send me a text and be like, hey, do you want to meet us here at the bar? I'd have to walk from our apartment to the liquor store just to get a bottle of vodka to drink, to go meet him and our friends to drink. Like, I couldn't even just go directly to the bar. I had to drink before I could meet people to drink. And then I would get there and I would play this game of like catching up to this invisible line that existed somewhere, right? It's the moment that I got there, I was just like on fire to order, you know, more drinks from the bartender. And really quickly, the embarrassment of ordering more than one at a time just kind of evaporated, because I knew when I would order one, it would literally just be sucked down a straw in 2 minutes flat, and getting their attention and waiting for them to make a second drink was unbearable, having to wait for a whole 5 minutes. So I would order a couple as soon as I would get there. I'm serious. It was unbearable. Right. And so I would order a couple as soon as I would get there, and I would just suck them down super quick. And it would just be this game of like trying desperately to reach this line of where I felt okay and I felt that sense of ease and comfort, and trying not to cross over it. And I failed every time in attempting to do that. And one of two things would usually happen. Well, one of three things. But the first two things would happen is either I would order drinks in rapid succession, suck them down, and get too drunk too quick and have to let everyone know, hey, I'm feeling tired, I'm going to go home, you know, I'll see you when you get home. So I wouldn't be able to get that sense of ease and comfort, or I would get too drunk too quick, and I knew I couldn't stay out in public in that way, because I knew that, even though I didn't know why, I knew I wouldn't be able to stop drinking. Even though I knew I would probably black out or be puking in the bathroom or be making a fool of myself and anyone who happened to be with me, I knew I wouldn't be able to not drink if I stayed. So I would excuse myself and I would catch a cab or catch, you know, the bus home. The other thing that would happen is no matter how much I consumed, I couldn't get back to that line where I felt that ability to take a breath and exhale and feel that ease and comfort. Like no matter how much or how hard I drank, I wasn't able to recapture that feeling. And I would feel such heightened uncomfortability that I would have to do the same thing. I'd have to excuse myself and go home early. So it didn't matter which state I got to or desperately tried to get to but failed to get to. Neither state allowed me to stay and be a fiance to this man, be a friend to our friends, be anywhere in that realm of social drinking. The other thing that would happen is the allergy would be activated with drinking, and then the thought would switch to, well, you could stay if you just went to go get some other stuff to keep you up. So basically, no matter what happened, no matter what my plan was, it would usually end up with me going home early and going home first. And some of the external consequences that happened, two things that I've never done sober because they're bad plans. I would get into a taxi cab with a wallet full of money. I'd pull up and the car would pull up in front of our apartment. And then I would say, oh, I forgot my wallet inside. Can you sit here while I go and get some cash for you? And then I'd go inside and I'd pass out. And this happened on more than one occasion. On at least one occasion, my fiance came in an hour later after he came home after last call, flicked the lights on, pulled the cover off the bed, And I actually yelled at him. I was like, what are you doing? Why are you bothering me and waking me up? He's like, there's an angry taxi cab driver outside and the police. What did you do? You know? And the next day, like, piecing all of this together, I was like, that's a really dumb plan. Why did you do that? But I did it again. Like, after the night that those cops came and he had to find the cab driver and the police, like, I did it again. There was a time where I got way too wasted too quick at the bar, and I wandered from the bar to the Wawa a couple blocks away and then proceeded to try to shoplift a bunch of food that I don't even eat. And I had no recollection of that. Like, that information had to be delivered to me the next day, because his friend had seen me at the Wawa almost get arrested and sort of intervened and put me in a cab to go home. And these sort of things started to, again, like, none of those things make me an alcoholic, right? Like, me trying to rip off cabbies or me almost shoplifting at Wawa, getting into sort of external kind of trouble with those external consequences, those don't make me an alcoholic, right? But what they started to do was fill me with that incomprehensible and pitiful demoralization the next morning, the kind that, like, you can't shake. The mornings that I would wake up with somewhat of a recollection of what I said and did the night before and be mortified, those were terrible. But the mornings where I woke up to with little to no recollection at all were, like, the worst. They were the worst because I could have said or done anything. And I don't know. And I don't know if I'll ever know. But I know that you know. And I don't know what it is that you know that I did or said. And I know that if I drink again, I'm in danger of acting and saying and doing and behaving in that sort of manner. And I'll have no control. But I can't not drink. And I don't know why. Towards the end of my drinking, like I said, I was just trying to drink, and it was one incident after another. And I think I was really confused with what was going on. At a certain point, I started to be aware that, like, you might have a drinking problem. But being an alcoholic wasn't on my radar. I had a lot of old ideas of what it meant to be an alcoholic, and I wasn't living under a bridge drinking out of a brown paper bag. I wasn't waking up in the morning shaking or having DTs if I didn't drink. I was under this delusion that because I thought I was making the choice to drink in the mornings, it wasn't alcoholic drinking, right? Like, if there would have been a physical withdrawal, I would have had to face, like, hey, man, you're an alcoholic. I thought I was on my way to becoming an alcoholic. I remember doing something so absurd. You know, like, how you can type into Google or whatever, different, your height, your weight, your gender, how active you are, and get your body mass index, right? I wanted to know if there was a way for me to determine that I was a 38-year-old female of this weight, drinking this much per week, and if I continue drinking at this rate, how long will it take for me to become physically dependent? Like, I was trying to figure that out because I couldn't imagine not drinking, but I didn't know how to stop or moderate on my own. And this old idea I had was, like, when physical dependence presented itself, that I'd have to accept that I was an alcoholic and either get treatment or not. And I had no idea I'd been an alcoholic my entire life, even before I picked up a drink. I was waiting for someone to talk to me about it, my drinking, and that didn't happen. The approach that was made by my fiance was, you need to get your head together or we're done. That's the ultimatum I got. And all that did was reinforce the old idea that I drink the way that I drink and I use the way that I use because of all of these mental and emotional disorders that I've been diagnosed with by doctors. And because of all of my years in and out of treatment and my years, you know, hanging out in AA rooms, I've never been able to diagnose myself, or no one had ever approached me in a way that got through and I was able to hear and understand what an alcoholic was, what this disease is. I just missed all of that. And so, you know, his ultimatum just reinforced, it's all this mental and emotional stuff, and I need to get that under control. And once I do, then the drinking will get under control. I think I got a therapist. I had all sorts of wacky ideas of what was going to help that mental and emotional disorders, and nothing worked. Nothing changed. And I was sitting in front of the computer one night, and I didn't know what to do. This is where I was stuck that night. There's a part in the book that says, and I'll just read in the first person, I couldn't picture life without alcohol. Someday, and it was that day, I was unable to imagine life either with or without it. Then I knew loneliness as such few do. I was at the jumping off place. I wished for the end. That's where I was that night, sitting in front of the computer. And I did some, like, really wacky things before I got directed to where I ended up going. The first thing was, you know, maybe he's right. Maybe it is all this psychiatric stuff. Maybe I should just check myself into the psych ward. And the next thought was like, you know, that's not it. You know, it's something deeper than that. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it wasn't just all the psychiatric stuff. So I scratched that idea off the list. And the next thought was, even though there's no physical dependence and you're not going through withdrawal when you stop drinking, maybe you should just go to treatment, right? You don't need a detox, but maybe you should just go to inpatient. Maybe that'll be helpful and useful. And the next thought was, you've been to treatment. Like, I've been to dozens of treatments, right? And I absolutely needed to go, you know, to those detoxes. Those were necessary to physically detox me and keep me separated from what I was doing. But all those times I stayed inpatient after for 28 days or however, all those times I went to IOP and rehab after work, none of those things, like certain aspects of those treatments got me sober, got me physically sober, but none of them kept me sober. And none of them brought me real recovery, which I wasn't aware of yet. And so I sort of crossed that, you know, possibility off the list. And the next thing I remember thinking, and there was just this, like, all of this noise inside of my head. It was so loud. It was like the volume dial was turned all the way up, and I couldn't do anything to lower it except take a drink, right? But I desperately didn't want to take a drink that night, right? I wasn't thinking of swearing it off forever and for good, but in that moment, I did not want to drink, but I didn't know how not to not drink. And the noise inside of my head was deafening. And the next thought that I heard amongst all of this chaos was, I wish there was a place where people understood what I'm going through, where people understand what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling, that I could go and talk to, or that I could just listen to, because I'm too much of a coward right now to even open my mouth and say anything. And what happened in the next instance, I absolutely believe is a miracle. All of that noise inside of my head just got turned down, and a voice that was not in my own voice kind of nudged in and said, that's AA, you idiot. They use that voice, they use stronger language, but I'm going to respect the group's conscience here. It's like, that's AA, you idiot. You need to go find a meeting. And so I Googled Alcoholics Anonymous in my neighborhood, and I found a meeting. And I went to that first meeting, and it was in a little church basement. And there's a big, long table with chairs around the table, and then chairs right around those chairs up against the wall. And I was trying to figure out where the chairperson was going to sit. At the head of the table, like which end was the head of the table, so I could sit at the opposite end in the back of whatever the back of the room in the corner was. And I didn't see a book on the table. I didn't see what I thought was the Bible on the table, so I couldn't determine which end the chairperson would be at and where everyone would be looking at the speaker. So I just took a gamble, and I decided I think that's the back corner of the room, and I went and sat in the back corner. And a few minutes before the meeting started, a young bubbly girl with blue hair and tattoos, like, sat down in the, at the head of the table next to me, and she said, hey, my name's Kat, what's your name? I was like, my name's Kat. She's like, hey, I'm an alcoholic, is this your first time here? And she asked me a couple questions, and I laughed out loud. That little moment of it just being so absurd that a blue-haired tattoo girl named Kat was greeting me at this first meeting back was enough to, you know, kind of break this. I was just full of fear. I was so full of fear. And I attended that meeting, and after that meeting was over, she told me there was going to be a meeting there in 2 days and that I should come back. And I did. And it was probably a speaker discussion meeting. And after that meeting, at the beginning of the meeting, they asked if there were any new people or any people counting days, and I had raised my hand. And after that meeting, a woman approached me. And and she did something for me that had never been done in a way that was able to reach me. She introduced herself. She asked who I was and if it was my first time, you know, at AA ever. If it was my first time, you know, at that meeting, if I was just coming back. She asked a few general questions. Like, she asked if I had ever done the steps as outlined in the book or had a sponsor. And I answered them. And the next thing she did is she, like, switched gears. And she started to talk about herself, and she started to talk about her drinking and the way that she used to drink and the way that she used to think and the way that she used to feel. And what I remember from 20 years ago going to meetings or especially in treatment or aftercare, is everyone was grilling me about what I was doing and what I needed to start doing, what I needed to stop doing. And I hated that. Even when I desperately wanted to stop using back then, it just felt like backed into a corner. And my ability to stick around and see anything through that was going to be helpful or useful was just like minuscule. And as soon as I met this woman and she got out of the way, you know, the first little questions of like, hey, are you new? What brings you here or whatever? Like she stood up and started to talk about herself. And it was wild. This woman stood before me with her head held high with dignity and grace. And she talked about just how low and hopeless she got during her drinking. She talked also about how she felt and how she thought. And all I could think with every sentence that she said was like, oh my God, me too. I did that too. I did that. But wait, you might have done that worse than me. There was so much identification and it was awesome. And I was just either nodding my head or like confirming in my, you know, to myself in my mind that I had done that too. I think a couple times I interjected and shared some of my stories, which is exactly what the directions and working with others tell us to do, right? Like that's how we get the newcomer to open up. And we continued that like that for a while, and then she started to describe herself as an alcoholic, right? So after like 5 minutes of having a conversation about how she drank, and I'm like, I drank that way too. I felt that way too. I thought that way too. Then when she shifted into describing herself as an alcoholic and suffering from this disease of alcoholism, I started to ask myself, like, wait, maybe you're already an alcoholic. See, I had like an old idea, and I had confusion about what goes on here. I thought that I was going to come to AA, and you guys were going to tell me that I could never have another drink again, and you were going to tell me, you were going to diagnose me and say that I was an alcoholic and that I belonged here with you. And that's not what happened with this woman, right? And so as she starts to describe herself as an alcoholic and starts to talk about what alcoholism is, I was like, dude, I'm already suffering from these things. I don't think I need to wait for physical dependence to develop. Like, I think I might already be an alcoholic. And then she asked me if it didn't make sense. Like the woman who stood before me didn't match up with the woman she described herself as being, right? Like I didn't run back into AA because I had this desire to cease drinking forever. I didn't run back into AA to find God. I didn't run back into AA to help my fellows. Like I was looking for a way out. That's it, right? When I start to like mull over in my head, like maybe I'm already suffering from this alcoholism thing, and it starts to not compute that the way that this woman described herself as living doesn't match up with the woman who's standing in front of me, I start to get really curious. I'm like, what did you do? Like, what did you do to be saved from this living death that you described? Because you're not sick and suffering like that anymore, right? Like, you seem happy and free. And she told me that she was taken through the 12 steps as outlined in the big book. She asked if I was interested in doing that with her and if I was willing to go to any lengths to do that. And I said yes. And the only reason I was is because I was desperate. Like I needed to be broken into like a million little pieces, to be willing to do any of this. And she got me right into the book and right into the steps. And when she took me through that doctor's opinion, can't even read what the notation is in my book because it's an expletive, but I have with that first full paragraph in the doctor's opinion that talks about we believe the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy, and then it goes on. I have like, this blew my mind, my something mind, right? When she said that, I actually laughed out loud and I stopped her and I was like, Aubrey, there's no way I'm allergic to alcohol. I've literally been drinking every day of my life for 20 years. Like I put stuff in me every single day. There's no way I'm allergic. Because I had this, you know, when you think of the word allergy, I just think of some sort of reaction, right, that makes me sick or makes it impossible for me to keep doing it, right? And she's like, oh, like, just think of an allergy as a phenomenon, like something that can't be explained, and that basically, like, we react differently when we put alcohol in our body than other people. And when she went on to read, like, the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. And then it says, like, these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Like, that was never presented to me. And I think that had it been presented to me 20 years ago, I would have been like, you are a lunatic, and that doesn't even make any sort of sense. I think I needed those 20 more years of either being driven by that allergy right up until the very last day of drinking, where I'm like, I don't want to drink today, and I can't not do it, and I don't know why, right? I needed to be exactly where I was for this to make any sort of sense that I was going to be willing to accept. And then we went through, like, you know, the next couple chapters that really perfectly lay out what this mental obsession or these mental blank spots that we suffer from are. And what happened is I started to have, in reverse, the most powerful first step experience, right? I wasn't one of these alcoholics that was like sitting on a bar stool aware that I was kept drinking and ordering another one, because the allergy had been activated and the phenomenon of craving was basically making that decision for me. And I wasn't one of these alcoholics where in between, where I would, what would happen when I would not drink is I would either, all I could think about would be drinking. That's it. That's all I could be thinking about is that I need a drink, I want a drink, that's all I want to do. Or all I would be thinking about was how desperately I did not want to drink. But when I was not drinking, I was only ever thinking about alcohol, either wanting to do it or not wanting to do it. So I was like this slave to alcohol, whether I had the desire or had, you know, an aversion to wanting to do it. And when we got to that first, I love the part in the first paragraph of We Agnostics, because if you haven't been able to diagnose yourself with this, you know, disease with the chapters before, this sentence that says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And that was me. And when we read that, I was like, yeah, that's me. Like, I'm absolutely an alcoholic. Like, what do I have to do? And having such a powerful first step experience going through these earlier chapters in the book and looking back over the history of my life and my drinking, and put it into a different perspective where, like, once I started, I could not stop. I was never in control when I started to drink. Even if I kept it under control, I was not the one deciding how much I would drink, what else I would do, where I would go, what I would say, who I would hurt. And those in-between times when I would be trying to take it easy, that mental obsession would settle back in. And what would happen is I would have like these two opposite parallel thoughts running down the sides of my brain. And on one side, it would be the memory of the humiliation, the suffering from a week or a day or whatever last night before, and how I burned my life to the ground and all the consequences that I just suffered and that I'm sure to suffer if I pick up a drink again. And going down parallel on the other side of my brain will be the most trivial, ridiculous excuse I can even fathom that in my mind at that time seems sound, right? And no matter how hard I fight, or those thoughts fight against each other, that trivial, insane, you know, excuse wins out every single time. But I'm not aware of any of this until I sit down with another woman armed with the facts and we start going through this book. And it was spooky going through this book. I was just like, who are these old white dudes who are following me around, like literally over my shoulder, because they're describing exactly how I drank, how I thought, and how I felt. And the other thing that got presented to me, like I always thought, like, well, you have a problem with alcohol, or you have a drug problem. And I do remember like counselors or, you know, people in treatment facilities being like, you know, you can't go and, you know, shoot that stuff into your arm when you leave here. You can't do this, you can't do that. Everyone kept telling me, like, you can't drink again, you can't get high again. When I met Aubrey, she said something different. She's like, if you're a real alcoholic, it's not whether you, like, you will drink again. Like, if you don't treat this with a spiritual solution, it's not like the question of if you'll drink again, right? It's like you will, right, if you suffer from the spiritual malady. And some things were put into a perspective that I started to understand. Like, I always thought, like, my problem is alcohol, so the solution is absence, you know, abstinence from alcohol. What would happen when I would attempt to remain abstinent from anything I was doing is those bedevilments on page 52 would come like full force. And the thing is, those bedevilments, when you don't, look, when I don't understand these, like the physical and mental and spiritual aspect of alcoholism, those bedevilments just look like manic depressive disorder, major depressive disorder, and suicidal thoughts, or low self-esteem, or the world is wrong in me, right? But like that trouble with personal relationships, couldn't control my emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, couldn't make a living, had a feeling of uselessness, were full of fear, were unhappy, couldn't seem to be of real help to people. As soon as I would eliminate drugs and alcohol, those would be on me so hard that living and existing in sober skin and trying to navigate through those things was unbearable. That it would drive me to make that supreme sacrifice of just picking up, even though I know I would burn my life to the ground again. And so when I got here and it was laid out in this way that, like, alcohol is not the problem, right? Lack of power is the problem. the only logical solution for a lack of power problem is access to power. And she let me know that these steps outlined in this book were going to be like the way that we cleared all of this debris away so that I could get access to power, so that I didn't have to drink again, right? Instead of, you know, someone approaching me and being like, you can't do this anymore, it was like, no, you're going to drink again, and if you don't want to, let's do these steps, clear this debris, get closer to this power, and that's going to solve all your problems. And we just got right into the steps, and I remember sitting in the front seat of her car, and I didn't know we were doing 1, 2, and 3, but we did them right in the front seat of her car, and I stopped her. And it wasn't because I was unwilling, but I was unsure if this would work, because I came in 20 years ago with all sorts of prejudice against the Catholic God I had been raised to fear, and that was going to send me to hell. When I came in 4 years ago, I had a little less prejudice, only because I was dying inside. But I stopped her before we got to that third step prayer, and I was like, whoa, whoa, wait a second, like, I'm willing to believe that there is a power, but I don't even know what that is. I can't define it. I can't articulate it. Will this not work until I reach, you know, some sort of like defined, you know, version of what this power is going to be for me? And she kind of chuckled and she's like, do you believe that I believe in a power greater than myself? And I was like, absolutely. It saved you from a living death. Like, you're sitting here with me. And she's like, that's all it needs. Like, it just says we're willing, right? And that that desperation is what allowed me to be willing enough to just go ahead and take that third step prayer. And she outlined step 4 right there in the front seat of her car and had, you know, gave me a 2-week limit to get that done. I did a 5th step with this woman, and I was as honest as I could be, which wasn't absolutely honest, but it was as honest as I could be at the time. Fear drove me to eventually be honest with her and make a really beautiful amends to someone who was on my amends list. A lot of people leave things off of their 4th steps and then don't, you know, keep them out of their 5th steps. And I did the opposite. I added something to my 4th step that never happened to me. And then I told my sponsor this thing happened to me. At some point in going in and out of treatment, like, they would ask these same questions, like, did this ever happen to you? Did anyone touch you? Did this happen at home? Did anyone beat you? And at some point I'm like, I guess this is what makes people drink and use drugs. So I just said yes at some point. But I wrote it down on that 4th step, and I told her it happened in the 5th step. And then I went home to do 6 and 7, and I had so much fear of having been dishonest, but she gave me directions to go home and do 6 and 7, and I had more fear of not following the directions. So I went home and did 6 and 7. And I prayed and I asked this power to remove that fear so that I could come clean and be honest. And eventually I was. And when I went to make amends to my mom, I was able to be honest with her about something that I had said happened that she would have been peripherally tethered to that didn't happen. And I set her free from years of just being baffled and confused and not knowing, or you know, knowing that it couldn't have happened, but I said it did and whatever. So that was probably the most powerful amends I ever made, and I continued to make amends, making amends to my dad, and just it was probably the most emotional ones I amends I had made. And he just sat next to me and held my hands while I sort of wept and started to admit a bunch of things to him, some of which he knew, but that I, you know, could never be honest about, some of which he didn't know. And he chuckled. Both of my younger sisters are sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's like, you know, your little sisters did this thing with me, but they weren't as thorough or specific. And I was like, oh, that's fine. That's their journey. This is mine. And I got into 10 and 11. I mangled 10 and 11 because I don't have enough time to get into it. But basically, a lot of people in Philly were asking, like, are you on your 10th step? We can do 10th step nightly reviews. Even though there are specific directions on step 10, which is like walking around with God in your pocket throughout the day, to look for those, you know, selfishness, resentment, dishonesty, fear, and do 4 things in response immediately. Instead, I was waiting till the end of the night to write this 10-step nightly review, which is not a thing. And all I was doing for 11 was praying and meditating, even though there are beautiful pages 86 to 88 on how to do your 11-step nightly review and then upon awakening in the morning. But I was doing something, right? And then when I started to sponsor other women, take them through the book and take them through those pages, I'm like, I'm not doing this. Why am I not doing this? And I started to do it, and I experienced a whole new level of freedom and closeness to this power that is absolutely responsible for everything that has happened in my life. And I think my most favorite thing to do in this entire process is having the privilege and the honor of taking other people through this book and through these steps. It was only because of this woman who approached me with kindness and compassion and patience, and the willingness to like stick with me as stubborn as I could be, that this miracle happened, that I was able to get connected to this power. And I feel like it's an awesome responsibility to be able to share that with other people, and see the light go on in someone's eyes, right? Because the light in my eyes was almost out at the end. And I was at the end, before I wandered back into that meeting, I was waking up wishing that I felt suicidal. I had felt suicidal before in my life. I'd acted on those feelings and thoughts before. That wasn't where I was 4 years ago. I almost wished that I was, because then I could have just ended it all. I was someplace so much darker, and I was just really confused and really afraid. I remember the thing that Aubrey promised me when, you know, before we got into the book and the steps. She's like, Kat, I'm not going to promise you that you can pick up the old broken pieces of your life and kind of glue them back together into some semblance of a life. She's like, I'm not even going to promise you a new and improved life. She's like, if you follow the directions and these steps as outlined in this book, I'm going to promise you a brand new life beyond your wildest dreams. And thank God I had enough, I don't even know, whatever in me to listen to this woman and to go ahead and go through these steps in this book. Alcoholics Anonymous and these steps in this book and all of this stuff, this is the last thing I ever tried. It was the last thing I would have ever wanted to try, and it's the first and only thing that has ever worked in my entire life to get and keep me permanently and continuously sober and enjoy a freedom that is just totally wild. So that's all I have.
Thanks again, Kat. That was great. Let's give her a round of applause.